CataractClubs.com podcast series, episode number 157 with Dr. Mary Q. Innovating surgical techniques like scoping, turtleplasty, MIGS, and more from a brilliant surgeon at the Cleveland Clinic. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today, I got a very special guest. That's Dr. Mary Q from the Cleveland Clinic, a glaucoma specialist who I saw speaking at the New Orleans Academy of Ophthalmology. Fantastic meeting, by the way. And I loved her lecture. I was like, wow, you've got so much to share. We got to get the word out to the Cataract Coach audience. Mary, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, so yeah, you had some fantastic lectures. Now, I also did some homework and looked up about you. You're like, you would have been the dream child that my parents would have loved. Go to Stanford undergrad, UCSF for med school, Wilmer Hopkins for your residency, Cleveland Clinic for glaucoma fellowship. God, holy, that's like four home runs in a row.
I hope they're proud of me and made their immigration across the Pacific Ocean worthwhile.
Right. I mean, I'm kind of similar, but I'm sad to say I disappointed my parents.
I'm an only child, too, so they had no backup plan.
Well, you know what? You hit it a home run out of the park.
Thank you.
Now, when you finished your fellowship at Cleveland Clinic, you actually then took a faculty position somewhere else.
That's right. I first went to the University of Chicago. I was hired by this chairwoman, Catherine Colby, and I was really excited to go there and build up a glaucoma division with her there. But then during COVID, she left and went to NYU to become chairwoman there. And so then a few years later, I was able to leave University of Chicago and go back to my alma mater at Cole Eye and help lead some new expansion projects with the glaucoma fellowship back here at Cole.
Well, that's always a fantastic sign where the place that you trained at says, no, we want you back as faculty. Like you obviously, you were an all-star then. As a fellow, they obviously loved you to want to recruit you back as faculty.
It was nice to get to go somewhere different for a couple years to sort of like get on my own two feet and try out some of my innovative, weird ideas without having anyone else around me like asking me, what am I doing? And so it was actually an interesting experience to be 5 years out of training by the time I came back, because I got to have a little bit of like a separation in time and space, I guess, just from everyone who had known me as a fellow. And then to get to sort of show everyone everything I had done my time away, it was pretty cool to get to come back. For example, my job like grand rounds talk was about neovascular glaucoma. And during that talk that I gave when I interviewed for the job to come back, I had mentioned that my interest in neovascular glaucoma really started from my fellowship year there. So it was very full circle to get to come back 5 years later and give a lecture on this topic that I had kind of like gone away and done a lot of work on, and then to bring it back to my home institution.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. A lot of young doctors, and me 20 years ago also, didn't realize that your first couple years in practice, you learn more than you did in the prior 10 years. That's unbelievable, right?
That's what I tell my residents and fellow too, as they are finishing up and about to get their first job. I'm kind of like, the next couple years is actually the hardest. Like this was just for you to learn the alphabet. And now you have to learn all the hard stuff with the language of being a glaucoma surgeon.
Right. Your residency and fellowship are literally just the building blocks.
Yeah.
You're learning how to learn so you can keep teaching yourself, because you're not teaching some magic in fellowship. Because imagine if you did a glaucoma fellowship, if you were old like me, you did a glaucoma fellowship 25 years ago, they didn't know how to spell MIGS.
That's exactly what my mentor from Cole, John Isengard, said to me when I was a fellow. He said when he was a fellow at Michigan back in the day, he had only learned how to do trabs, second trabs, tubes and CPCs, and everything else that he does now, all the new innovative stuff, he learned once he was in practice. And so hearing that from him made me feel very comfortable just going off into practice. And if I needed to try something new or come up with something new, to just know that that's kind of normal and you're supposed to just take the building blocks that you learned in training and kind of go with it. And so that's what I tell my trainees too. They're not going to learn everything in this small amount of time in training, but just get comfortable with the fundamentals so that they can keep going their whole career.
Right. I think that's one of the things that I guess certainly at the time I never realized. When I was a resident, I was like, I guess I was dumber than a bucket of rocks, because I felt like, you're going to teach me and then I'm set for life. I'll know everything. And then you realize I literally know nothing.
Yeah. Like, you know, just barely enough to get started and enough that you know how to find out more. And that's about as much as you're going to get when you start. Right. I remember the first time I had to do something new. It was a Ahmed capsule excision that I had never done before. And Dr. Isengard, my mentor, had showed me a video of it and I needed to do this for one of my patients. And he said, here's a video example. And then I just went ahead and did it. And then I was like, okay, yeah, I know how to do new things as long as I understand the principles of how to handle tissue and, you know, hemostasis and all these fundamentals. And so the first time I tried something I had not done in training empowered me to go off and do a bunch more things that I'd never done in training.
Right, for sure. I think it's one of the key lessons. Whenever I talk to young ophthalmologists, say, number one, keep learning. Push yourself every day. You gotta keep learning. Embrace new technologies, new ideas, new techniques. And then finally, always just ask, well, what can we do better? What can we do better? Keep pushing the envelope there.
Yeah, absolutely. We just had an OR day on Monday where we were fixing a cyclodialysis cleft, and my fellow had just learned this new technique to fix it, which was this ab interno method, and I felt comfortable that she could probably do it that way. So then I said, well, let's try it this other way that I think might be better because we already know this way, so let's go ahead and push the envelope forward a little bit more, just to always be trying to learn something new, some better, safer way to do something.
Right, right. And if looking back on my career, I finished residency in 2000. You finished in 2018. So I'm like way older, hence the gray hair and lack of hair. But if I look back, yeah, your first 5 years in practice, you learned so much.
Mm-hmm.
You get your reps in finally. You can rack up a few thousand cases on them, you know, because you finish residency with a couple hundred, maybe 500 cases. You think you're amazing. Yeah, that's the tip of the iceberg. And then
the first 5 years is also where I learned how to teach surgery, because in my residency and fellowship, we had some opportunity to mentor junior residents, but it wasn't like, you know, some fellowships have a fellow, for example, like at a VA where they're working with the residents every week or something, but our fellowship at Cole doesn't have a VA like that. And so when I took my first job, it was kind of a leap of faith that I thought I wanted to teach. But I never had that much practice teaching because it just wasn't built into my training. But you know, my fifth grade yearbook, when it said, what do you want to be when you grow up? My answer was doctor or teacher. So like, I always knew, I just didn't even like know what that would feel like. And so in my first 5 years, it was my chance to work out, how do I want to be a teacher in the clinic and in the OR, and just kind of coming up with standardized ways to teach residents to do certain procedures safely. I really worked out a lot of that. So then when it was time to come back to Cleveland Clinic 5 years later, I was able to bring all that experience with me and hit the ground running here.
Oh, that's fit. You got to have a picture of that fifth grade yearbook and put it on your Instagram. You got to, because you are now both a doctor and a teacher. You're both.
It's on there. I think it's like I posted it like last year. I found it when my mom was cleaning out their house because they're trying to downsize. And so she took all my old stuff and put it in a bunch of boxes and said, hey, just like bring this with you to your house. And I flipped through it and I thought that was so cute. I felt like I had like achieved my childhood dream. So I did. I posted it on Instagram. But the other thing it said was, what was your favorite animal? And at the time I had put cat, but I have a dog now. So
You have a dog named after where you did your residency, Hopkins.
That's right. My dog is Hopkins the Chow Chow. You can follow him on Instagram, hopkins.the.chow. My husband and I met each other at Hopkins in residency. He was an ENT resident there and I was an ophthalmology resident there. And so when we got together and got married, we wanted to get a dog and we always just knew we were going to name him Hopkins.
So
that's how we met.
That's such a cute story. You know what's crazy when you think back? Like the generation before me, it was the ENT and ophthalmology were the same subject. It was ENT.
Yeah.
And even it used to be the American Academy of Ophthalmology and Otolaryngology. It was AAOO. People don't realize.
Wow. Yeah. I think each of those two specialties has just gotten so much more complex and we've learned so much more about ophthalmology and ENT that I guess it's had to branch off. I mean, now I only specialize in glaucoma. Like I can't imagine specializing in all of ophthalmology plus all of ENT. That just seems like a really broad set of things to have to master.
Right. I mean, it's funny, you know, I didn't just anterior segment work. And so I had someone send me a patient. I'm like, that's a retina problem. I don't do retina. And the person was so a non-medical person was so flabbergasted. They said, two things the size of walnuts, you can't do the whole thing?
Mm-hmm.
How hard can it be? I'm like, you'd be surprised.
And then the neuro-ophthalmology referral for me, when I say, oh, I'm only a specialist in optic nerve problems that are related to pressure, but I'm going to send you to a specialist that deals with optic nerve problems that don't have to do with pressure. Like that sounds so silly to the patient, but we just know so much about so much of ophthalmology that we need all these different specialists.
Right. I mean, the amount of new material, golly, It's so much harder to be a resident now.
Yeah.
Learn everything I learned 25 years ago, plus all the new stuff that we figured out the last 25 years in the same amount of time.
Apparently, ophthalmology residency in some other countries can be like 7 years. I learned some of this when I go to these international conferences and meet trainees from around the world. And I was surprised to hear that at some places it was that long. So now
I'm
really fit everything in the time we have.
Yeah, I think, but if we focus on doing this, the basics, the building blocks, and kind of teaching you how to learn in ophthalmology, then I think you'll be fine. But yeah, in the UK, I've heard that there, you can easily do 7 years for ophthalmology.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a question, like, how much are you learning and how much are you doing? Are you cheap labor for the NHS? Like, there's a balance in there somewhere.
Yeah, that's a real fine line that we have to walk when we are designing our fellowships. We just expanded our fellowship at Cleveland Clinic from one spot to two spots. So we matched two for next year. It's Sabrina Doss from Kresge and Ryan Claxton from Emory. And we're really excited to have them. And as we were applying for this extra spot through our institution, we had to go through this whole process where we explained that this was going to be educational. We have a lot of teaching cases, and this was not just our attempt to bring in more cheap labor to help, you know, our team get stuff done. So that's really great that Cleveland Clinic has a system in place with a lot of great administrative support to help with these other tasks so that the fellows can actually focus on clinical surgical learning.
Yeah, there's a delicate balance there. And I've kind of changed my tune and come around over the last few years because I thought at the time I was trained the old school way. You know, first day of residency, they're like, there are three rules. No complaining, no complaining, no complaining. Any questions? I'm like, ooh, no, sir. Okay. It was a different kind of training then. I did in-house call for ophthalmology at UCLA's Jules Stein Eye Institute. In-house call. Like,
We had in-house call at Wilmer.
Oh, my gosh.
Q5 for the first year.
Wow.
It was busy.
Right. But then you think, you know, Medicare ends up paying for each resident. They take a fraction of that, pay it to the resident's salary, and keep the rest for training. And then you think you got a senior resident who's, let's say, 30-ish years old, plus or minus, incredibly smart, incredibly hardworking. And a senior resident, you're functioning at an incredibly high level. But on that team, you get paid a fraction of what the nurse practitioner and PA get paid on that team. And they could be younger than you.
Yeah.
How is that right?
What do you think would be right? What do you think would be the right way to train young doctors?
I think, you know what? The universities need to not just rely on whatever Medicare is paying them for the resident spot. We say, I have a saying in Spanish, abre la cartera, open the wallet. You're getting the value out of it. Just pay.
Yeah.
You'll attract. But, you know, I always thought, like, maybe one day I'd start my own fellowship, enter segment, complex enter segment fellowship. You know, the first thing I'd do is see whatever the highest paid fellowship was and triple it.
Right.
Because I want the best of the best candidates. And because you may not realize, as a fellow, you're going to generate, without blinking, $1 million of net revenue for the program. Without blinking. And then you're taking home, like, you're barely paying rent. I mean, I don't know, like, where Cleveland may be less expensive than LA, but you want to live on the west side of LA next to where you're doing your training. Oh, God. It's got to be university subsidized housing because you can't afford it otherwise.
I mean, that principle applies to paying everybody on your team, including technicians and OR staff and schedulers and everybody. If you want good people to do good work, open the wallet. And
I do.
Yeah.
Call my clinic. Person who answers the phone gets paid very, very well because they're that valuable. And I worked with them for 22 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, wait a minute. It's an incredible team. But yeah, you end up getting what you pay for.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You have to invest in it.
Right. Another fun thing. So we just enjoyed together where I heard about, I've got some notes here about the amazing surgical techniques you're going to do. And we're going to talk about those because I learned some. I took notes from your lectures. You're very, very good. At New Orleans Academy of Ophthalmology, what a great meeting. It was my fourth time doing it.
It was my first time and it was so fun and it was great to be up there with you and all the other speakers and it was an honor to be invited. I was actually the only female speaker this year. It was like a special honor to be the one woman up there, which was great.
You know what? I don't even look. My mom was a doctor. My mom's mom was a doctor. My three sisters are all doctors. The mother of my kids is a doctor.
My daughter is finishing med school now. So it is like, to me, it's like, okay. All the women are, every woman that's related to me is a doctor. I get it.
Yeah. I was just actually also speaking at a meeting in Moorfields last month, and some of the female trainees came up to me afterward and said that it was nice to see a young woman up there. That was really nice to hear, because I don't feel like I hear that as much in the U.S. There's a lot of women up there in the U.S. So it was just kind of cool to have some junior female trainees comment that that was inspiring to see.
Right. Now, you've done it. Your lectures were fantastic. Yeah, the meeting was just great. It was super high yield, such great speakers. So, yeah, my little thing is, the reason I've done it four times is anytime they ask me to go, I'm going.
If yeah. you invite
me, I'm coming every time. And it's so much fun and such a collegial group. And boy, they got that Mardi Gras, you know, New Orleans spirit. I had such a great time.
Me too. I told them the same. I'm happy to come back anytime if they'll have me.
Right. So on your lectures, one of the things I liked is, let's talk first about neovascular glaucoma. So even though now in my clinic in Beverly Hills, or my surgery center there, I do very, very little neovascular glaucoma because that population doesn't have a whole lot of neovascular glaucoma. But when I taught residents at, which was called Olive View UCLA Med Center, it's a big county hospital in Los Angeles. And we had, I must have done at least one or two Ahmed valves for NVG a week for 22 years. And so we did a tremendous amount of this because there's so much vasculopathy there. Bad BRBO, CRBO, bad hypertensive, bad diabetics. I mean, diabetes was a huge issue. But you had some incredibly important things. And I want to talk about your techniques for using or treating neovascular glaucoma.
All right. This is my favorite topic. For whoever's watching out there, yeah, neovascular glaucoma is this really terrible type of glaucoma that happens when your body grows blood vessels to try to bring your eye more oxygen, and the blood vessels are growing in the wrong place, and they grow into the drain of your eyeball, clog up the drain, makes your pressure go up. And if this is left unchecked, there's permanent scar tissue that grows into the drain.
Right.
And, you know, when I was a resident, even we had trabs, we had tubes, we had CPC. Those were pretty much the glaucoma procedures that existed. I was even before the era of MIGS at the beginning of my residency. And so if we saw a patient with neovascular glaucoma, they would get an anti-VEGF injection to make the blood vessels go away. They would get PRP to make the blood vessels stay away. And then for the pressure control, you would put in an Ahmed, which is what you just said you did one a week for 22 years. And a lot of times these patients, when they come in, they're still phakic, so they still have their natural lens. And so these Ahmeds are placed in the anterior chamber. And then over time, their cornea can decompensate because their anterior chamber is already a little crowded because of the synechiae between the iris and the angle. It's already making that space very crowded. And so then over time, okay, they eventually get a cataract surgery. Then they might have to get a tube repositioning. Then they have to get like a corneal endothelial transplant. And it's, and then the Ahmed might fail because we know that over time, valve tubes tend to fail more than non-valve tubes. And so this is just like a tale as old as time of, you know, what happens to a neovascular glaucoma patient that gets an Ahmed in the anterior chamber at the time of diagnosis. Oh, yeah. And then over time, the tube's going to erode, too. So we get a lot of tube erosions from these Ahmeds. I was just talking to my friend Aki Shukla at Columbia yesterday, where both of us were doing add-on tube erosion cases, and both of ours were NVG Ahmeds that had eroded. And so it's just a very common, you know, series of events. And so we, when I got to Cole for fellowship, I learned like a slightly different protocol for what we can do for patients who are presenting with NVG acutely that have high pressure and already have their entire angle zipped up with scar tissue. Because for patients like that, if you give them the anti-VEGF and the maximum pressure lowering medications, it's not going to budge their pressure at all because their drain is already fully scarred with scar tissue. And so instead of giving them an injection and then giving maximum medications and then waiting till tomorrow and the next day to see if the pressure comes down, because like it won't, and then doing the Ahmed in the next day or two when there could still be active bleeding in the eye and that could cause bleeding associated complications, I learned from my mentor, John Isengart, who actually just gave a talk at the American Glaucoma Society meeting this year, like last week, about CPC and all the different uses for CPC. he actually taught me that we can do prompt primary CPC, which is a laser procedure that decreases the fluid production in the eye. And normally I had learned that this was reserved for eyes with very bad visual potential. But actually, I mean, I was shocked with July when I started fellowship. Our first neovascular glaucoma case was this pilot, and his vision was 21/25 at the time of presentation. So I said, oh, wow, his vision potential is really good. Shouldn't we do an OMED? And Dr. Isengard said, no, we're going to do a CPC. We're going to use a lot of steroids, and you'll see. By post-op week one, his eye will be really quiet. His vision will be baseline. Like, you'll be surprised. You'll see. And so that's what we did. And indeed, that's what happened. And over the course of the year, I learned, okay, starting with CPC and quieting down the eye right away, lowering the pressure by decreasing the fluid production without having to go into the eye or putting any hardware in the eye, and then at the same time giving a lot of steroids and giving that anti-VEGF at the same time in the OR, is a great first step when you have an eye that is already at the end stages of NVG, which is that the angle is already completely closed. And at this point, the pressure is immediately controlled and the anti-VEGF is immediately on board. And now you have some time and you can keep injecting them every month. You can do the PRP with the retina doctors whenever, and the CPC can wear off. And as it starts to wear off, you can now plan for a staged cataract with a tube in the sulcus, which is much better for the long-term health of the cornea. At the American Glaucoma Society Surgery Day this year, Ying Han from UCSF talked about her trial that's ongoing called the DECLARE trial, where she's randomizing tubes to the sulcus versus the anterior chamber to try to get a little bit more evidence about whether sulcus tubes might truly be better for corneal endothelial health, because we suspect should be. And so if you have the opportunity to give an NVG patient pseudophakia and a sulcus tube, that should be better for them long term than staying phakic, having an anterior chamber tube, and then having that higher risk of corneal decompensation and erosion and all of it. Not to mention, when we start with the CPC, now the pressure is lower and the ciliary body has already been dialed down a little bit. So you don't need this immediate pressure control that you normally do with an OMED. So you actually buy yourself the privilege of getting to use a non-valve tube. And a non-valve tube doesn't open right away. You have to ligate it. Otherwise, the pressure is too low right away. And so when you ligate a non-valve tube, the pressure can be high for the first 6 weeks or so while you're waiting for the tube to open. And so normally when you have an acute NVG situation, you don't have 6 weeks. So you have to do an OMED because that'll work right away. But now that you've done this prompt primary CPC with a staged non-valve tube in the sulcus, later you get the privilege of choosing a non-valve tube. So I would typically choose at this point a ClearPath 250 because it's non-valve, but it's also the smaller size. So the risk of getting too low is not as severe as if you were to choose a 350. And then I put it in the sulcus, so it's far from the cornea. I always take the lens. My philosophy about leaving young people phakic when they have NVG is that they already have a really severe problem with their eye, the front of the eye, the back of the eye. They are going to get a cataract sooner or later. And at this point, trying to protect the long-term health of their cornea by putting the tube deeper in their eye, to me, feels like worth it to give up their accommodation.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I have a pretty low threshold to just err towards giving people sulcus tubes, because I think that this is sort of like a one and done. I mean, it's a two and done because it was a staged procedure. But if, you know, you get the CPC first and then you get your phaco and your sulcus non-valve tube, it's possible that you will not need any more procedures to control your glaucoma. The chances are pretty high. Whereas on the flip side, if you start with an OMED in the AC, the chances that you will need a phaco later are practically guaranteed. And then the chances that your OMED will fail and then you'll need either CPC later or a second tube or something is pretty high. And even in those settings, I actually don't do a second tube. I'll do a same quadrant tube exchange to try to minimize the amount of hardware that goes into people's eyes, because the more hardware you have in there, the more risk of erosion and infection and things like that. And so it's very common across the board to do OMEDs urgently for NVG. And I'm hoping to just get the word out a little bit that we can start with CPC for eyes that are presenting with total angle closure. So we've published our experience doing this at University of Chicago, my first job. Jessie Wang was a resident at University of Chicago, and I met her when she was in her first year of residency. And her first project that she worked on with me during her training was this project, all the eyes that got CPC first when they presented with NVG and closed angles. And so we just kind of wanted to describe our experience with that. Now Jessie Wang has gone off to do fellowship at Duke for glaucoma and has joined the faculty at Cole. So now she's my colleague, and it's really cool to get to work alongside her and all the other members of the glaucoma division taking care of all these NVG patients the way that Dr. Isengard taught me and I had taught her. And now we're trying to spread the word nationwide and internationally. So I've also kind of spoken on this subject at World Glaucoma Congress, for example. The other half of this protocol is for a completely different group of NVG patients. And, you know, this is part of the problem with NVG is we just call it NVG and it's not really that descriptive. We just need better nomenclature, more descriptive words to call these different stages of NVG. And they've done that for primary angle closure disease. They have words like primary angle closure suspect, primary angle closure glaucoma, acute angle closure crisis. And for NVG, we just call it NVG. And so one of the problems with getting everyone on the same page for NVG care is we're not speaking the same language. So now we're talking about open angle NVG versus closed angle NVG. And me and two of my colleagues, Catherine Sun from UCSF and Aki Shukla, who's now at Columbia, but was at Wills when we wrote this editorial, we wrote this editorial that we published in Ophthalmology Glaucoma, outlining some of the major barriers to improving NVG outcomes. And barrier number one was the nomenclature, standardizing the nomenclature. And Dr. Swaminathan, Swarup Swaminathan, who's currently at Bascom, he and I tried to put an editorial out there about 7 years ago proposing a new NVG nomenclature. And it was rejected from like seven journals. And they said, you know, why don't you gather some more data about these different stages and how they might differ in their outcomes and prognosis and just kind of come back when you have a little more data. So we put a pin in it for 7 years. And I spent 7 years, 5 years in my first job, working on this. And so last month we revised our editorial and we just resubmitted it. So we'll see if this catches on. But the point is that NVG eyes that have totally open angles and anterior segment NV versus NVG eyes that have partially open angles, partial synechial closure and anterior segment NV and high pressure, and NVG eyes that have totally closed angles and anterior segment NV and high pressure, these are different things. And
right.
Different states of existence. The treatment protocol may be different. We should not lump them together under NVG. And when we're talking to our retina colleagues or glaucoma colleagues, we should be really descriptive about which stage of NVG we're referring to. When you say, hey, I got an NVG patient in clinic with total synechial closure or with open angle, no synechiae. And so the other half of this protocol is for patients with open angles, because you can have an NVG patient show up, same symptoms, you know, decreased vision, red eye, pain, pressure. And you give them maximum medical therapy and their pressure comes down and you look and their cornea starts to clear and you look and they have the NVI, they have the NVA, and you take a gonio prism and you put it on the eye and you look and the angle is filled with NVA, but you see the TM and you see scleral spur and you're like, hey, this angle is still open. This is not closed angle NVG. This is open angle NVG. This is the earliest stages of disease. And this, ironically, paradoxically, is more urgent than the closed angle NVG that really turns as an emergency. This is a salvageable situation. This is like a Mac on RD. Your angle is still not shot yet, so we need to save it. And so with my retina colleague at University of Chicago, Demetris Gondra, who also recently just left University of Chicago to join our chair who hired us, Catherine Colby at NYU, as the new vice chair of research at NYU, she and I developed this protocol that we were going to do together for all patients at University of Chicago who showed up with open angles or partially open angles that we thought were salvageable. And we called this protocol Salvaging the Conventional Outflow Pathway in Neovascular Glaucoma, which spells scoping, which I thought was cute because the whole point of this is you need to do gonioscopy, and the scoping is the key. And when the angle is found to be open, Dr. Scondra or the retin team would start serial anti-VEGF injections, and we just decided arbitrarily on six, and she would inject them every month for 6 months in a row. And you could just guarantee that during that 6 months, the NV would not recur because the medication lasts a month. So if you just keep injecting it every month, the disease will stay quiescent.
And doing PRP too, right?
During this time, you do PRP. You have 6 months of like an umbrella of protection where you know the disease will not recur and the angle will stay open. And then you can do your PRP in multiple sessions guided by FA as slowly as you'd like. You can wait for the macular edema to resolve before you start lasering. Just while you're kind of getting that full PRP in place, you have this protection of your anti-VEGF. It's sort of like a synergistic protocol where the anti-VEGF is scheduled and the PRP goes in between. And once you feel like all the PRP has been delivered and there is just dense PRP everywhere and you do not have any room for any more PRP, then we would stop injecting, step away, and hope that the NV does not come back. But at least during that time when you're doing this protocol, the NV shouldn't come back.
And then is there a point though of no return when you put up your gonio prism and you say, you know what, that angle's too zipped up?
Yeah. I think the point of no return is about 75% zipped up. And this is based on this article from some Japanese authors, Wakabayashi. I've cited this paper many times. I hope to meet them someday at an international conference. That would be really cool, actually, because I say this person's name so often because I always cite this paper. And actually, World Glaucoma Congress is going to be in Japan, April 2027 in Kyoto. So maybe I'll try to find...
Beautiful city. Beautiful city. You got
to
go.
I'm looking forward to trying to go, and I'm going to try to find this person and introduce myself. But you know, that paper said that closed angle is pretty much anything above 75% PAS. So if they have 75% PAS, like across the whole angle, I'll go straight to CPC. But if they have less than 75% PAS with a good amount of the angle still open, I will give it a shot with scoping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once you do the anti-VEGF and you do the maximum medications, usually the pressure does come down a little bit, like enough, either it normalizes if the angle is totally open, or it'll just come down just enough that you no longer are in an emergency situation. And now you have time to wait till the NV fully regresses. Now that you don't have an eye with active NV, you can do intraocular surgery without fear of bleeding problems. And so in cases like this, when the pressure is still too high on their current medical regimen, I do this controversial thing where I do a GAT, which is a gonioscopy-assisted transluminal trabeculotomy. And that involves going into the eye's natural drainage pathway and threading a illuminated microcatheter or suture, but I like the illuminated microcatheter, the eye track. And you thread that into Schlemm's canal, send it all the way around, grab the other end, hold on to both ends, and pull. And that cuts through the entire TM, 360 degrees all the way around, and severs all those obstructions to aqueous outflow, and kind of restores an anatomic, physiologic aqueous outflow.
It unzips the zipped up angle.
Yeah. And yeah. Sometimes even if the angle doesn't appear to be zipped and it just looks like it's open and you think, why is the pressure so high if the angle looks open? It's actually because there's a invisible translucent fibrous membrane. And it used to be fibrovascular, but the vascular component has regressed and now it's just fibrous. Yeah. And so you look at it and it looks open. But when I operate on an angle like that, when you take a blade and you actually slice into the TM, you can then like see and feel that it's thicker than it normally would be, but you wouldn't have been able to tell just on gonioscopy. This is like something I'm going to try to do, is like try to see if we can image that with anterior segment OCT or something, like see if we can just reliably see a hyper reflective membrane there in front of the TM. We could call it like epitrabecular membrane of Q or something. And so if an eye has that membrane, then that should hopefully tell you that if you go do a GAT, you know, it's going to work because the blockage is at the TM and it's just kind of clear and invisible. And I have done this even for eyes that are half zipped up. We published a case report with my former resident, Jacob Cantor from University of Chicago, who went on to do fellowship at Wilmer and is on faculty there. He and I wrote up this case we did where the angle was half zipped up and the pressure was really high and it came down to like 30s on max meds. And then we waited a little while and we did a GAT and they got serial anti-VEGF injections every month and the pressure completely normalized. It went from 35 on maximum medications to 16 on zero medications for a year while she was getting serial injections and PRP. Kind of proof of concept that you can restore the physiologic outflow. And you know, why put a tube in an eye if you can just get their natural drain to work? A tube works great. If their natural drain is not going to work, I always tell patients, we're going to go to Home Depot, buy new pipes and plug them into your sink. But if we can just rotor-rooter the natural sink, I'd like to try that first. It has a better safety profile by far. And so nowadays we are trying to kind of offer that like a MIGS for quiescent open or partially open angle NVG, which is kind of totally controversial because the year that I started doing this, I remember going to AAO glaucoma subspecialty day and NVG was mentioned once in the entire day, and it was on a slide about how it was a contraindication for MIGS. So not only was nobody paying attention to NVG, you know, all we had to say about it was don't do MIGS in the setting of NVG. And I remember I first brought this suggestion up at IGC, which is Interventional Glaucoma Consortium that they now host at Moran every year with Ike Ahmed and Arsham Shabani and Rachel Simpson. And I mentioned, hey, everyone, like I'm trying GAP for NVG. And everyone was like, whoa, that sounds crazy, but let's see how it goes, you know? And so this past year, we were able to publish our experience doing the scoping protocol and GAT for people who qualify for all the patients at University of Chicago. The first author on this paper is Nikita Mokashi, who just matched for a retina fellowship at University of Colorado. And so she has decided to pursue retina to kind of join in this multidisciplinary team of people caring for NVG patients. So it's okay that she didn't go into glaucoma because she's doing retina, and together we're gonna solve NVG. But that's her first author paper describing how everybody did with the scoping protocol, which is largely that we were able to salvage the drain. And a lot of people did not require glaucoma surgery at all. And those that did, we could start with a MIGS. And only when it gets to the very severest stage, when the angle is just, you know, not going to work anymore, then can you go ahead with a sulcus tube and a non-valve tube so that you don't ever have to come back and fix the erosion, transplant the cornea, et cetera, et cetera.
So I think the amazing part here is you're shaking up the conventional dogma that NVG is not just NVG. NVG is a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem is I don't think I've ever heard anyone else explain that NVG is actually a spectrum. But now when you say it, you're like, duh, of course it is. You can have the very beginning and you can have the very, very end stage. There's a whole spectrum. And by treating them differently or tailoring your treatment to where they are on the spectrum of NVG makes a ton of sense. So with that regard, when 7 journals reject you, it means you're doing it right.
I feel like it means like you're on such the cutting edge that it's controversial enough.
No, listen, you got to change the dogma. Remember, today's dogma is tomorrow's dog food.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes what you're saying makes a ton of sense. And then I also love scoping. So if you said it so fast, I had to like make notes. But scoping is salvaging the conventional outflow pathway. That's the SCOP. In NVG,
glaucoma, it perfectly spells out scoping.
But it makes a lot of sense though.
Yeah.
But you're right. If it's my eye and I'm on the early stage of NVG, don't just throw a tube in my eye and have me suffer with all the downstream sequelae of that tube. Instead, like try salvage what I actually have. And obviously, your idea of injecting like Avastin or some anti-VEGF Q every month for 6 months, throwing down the PRP to help kind of block that stimulus of more VEGF makes a ton of sense.
What would also be great, which we can't really do currently, is a vitrectomy for everybody who has NVG. I went to ARVO maybe 5-10 years ago and saw this poster from, I think, somebody in Germany. And they said that for all their NVG patients, the retina service, or I guess just some comprehensive doctor that just does everything, they do like a phaco, or like a whole vitrectomy, they do endo laser, and then they'll do like ECP from the inside as well. I mean, that is a real one and done. Like this eye should be stable forever.
Well, here's the thing too, that you have to know your patient population. So when I was with my residents, all of you, again, county hospital, where the patients are very underserved, they will present with NVG with a crystal clear cornea. Their pressure has been rocking 58, you know, millimeters of mercury for the last 6 months. And their nerves are really getting cupped out. And they're pretty much asymptomatic. In those patients, and the angle is, forget 100% zipped up. They're like 200% zipped up. They zipped up once, zipped up again, and it's done. In those eyes, we just did everything at once. So go to the OR. If you're age 60 or above, you're becoming pseudophakic immediately. Calc the other eye, add a half or one diopter to the lens power, we're done. The IOL power is not the limiting step of surgery here.
Yeah.
We'd go in there, make them pseudophakic, but actually take out the cataract. While they're aphakic, put on you've already injected Avastin, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Put on the indirect ophthalmoscope, go to town, 2,000 spots. Brrr, all that PRP goes in. Put the IOL in, put in the Ahmed valve too. If you want, add a little bit, 180 degrees of CPC. Because here's the catch too, though, you have to know your population. We may see that patient on post-op day one.
Yeah, one shot.
And never see them again.
Yeah. I tell my trainees that when you meet a patient with NVG from diabetic retinopathy, the most important thing you can do for them is look at their other eye, because they probably have very early NVG on their way to becoming blind from it. And if all you can do is put PRP in the other eye, you have saved this person one eye's vision.
Oh, that is such an important point. In fact, one of my sayings was resins. They'd have their whole note written about this eye that has a 0.99 cup and it's like it's circling the drain.
Yeah.
And I'd say your entire note is about the $100 eye. But ask the patient, the other eye is the $1 million eye. And you've written nothing about the $1 million eye. And if you do nothing, that $1 million eye, which actually sees normally, is going to follow suit with the other eye.
And my very first NVG patient that I saw when I was an attending at University of Chicago, who I remember he came in on the day I was getting married. And okay. So it's just very memorable because the residents called me while I was like getting my marriage certificate. And he was hand motion in the bad eye, but 20/20 in the good eye. And he was really devastated about this bad eye being hand motion. And I said, I don't know if it's going to get better or not. Like it probably won't, but you know, we'll try our best, of course. Right. But the good news is that we caught the NVI in the other eye and the pressure was still normal. It was like 21. And then there was no PAS yet. And I said, the best thing that happened to you today is that we caught this in the other eye. We're going to start the scoping protocol for the other eye, which we did. And for the bad eye, we did CPC right away, followed by phaco and a sulcus tube. And as of when I left University of Chicago 5 years later, his bad eye recovered to 20/40, first of all. And
wow.
Thankfully, actually surprisingly doing well. And then his good eye is still 20/20 with an open angle because we got on it. And that is like a success story for NVG that should not be the exception. That should be the rule.
Right. If you're a young ophthalmologist, remember my rule of my residents was this patient presents to you, you're spending all your effort on the $100 eye. Because you ask your patient who's hand motion or LP in that bad eye, what's that eye worth to you? Maybe $100. What's the other eye worth to you? The actual eye that's still seeing normally. That's $1 million. That's the entirety of their life. And you've got to like exactly what you said, put all the effort into salvaging or the bad eye, of course, but also could you prevent the same train wreck from ever happening in the good eye?
And sometimes the good eye has, you know, some completely other thing going on that people are just like ignoring because they've been so focused on the bad eye. It's actually just like yesterday, I saw a patient who had NVG in the bad eye, and the bad eye is light perception and is stable and pseudophagic and fine. And the patient said, can you make sure my other eye's okay?
Right.
Yeah, of course. And then I just sort of like paused for a second to like mentally think about the other eye. And I remembered that her axial length was 20 millimeters and she has some appositional closure in the other eye. And this has nothing to do with NVG because her NVG was a unilateral process and she does not have diabetic retinopathy and she was not at risk of NVG in the other eye, but she's at risk of angle closure glaucoma.
A 20 millimeter eye, yeah.
Yeah. Like she needs to, you know, get a phaco sooner rather than later. And so I was so, you know, focused on making sure her NVG eye got stabilized that I was just like, okay, whenever you're stable here, we're going to like reassess everything. And it took her reminding me, hey doc, like, is my other eye doing okay? For me to just like mentally make a note of it. So always remind yourself about the other eye.
And remember, pseudophakia is a gift.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially absolutely. In an eye with a 20 millimeter axial length. If you can take out that 4.5 millimeter thick crystal lens, and slide in that less than 1 millimeter thin IOL, you've done everyone a huge favor.
Yeah, it's like creating space out of no space. Like you can't really generate things out of thin air often in life, like alchemy is not real, but you can create space in an eye and that's magic.
Now let's talk some more about complications from NVG. So as you know, the journey begins once you put, let's say this example I gave my patients in the county hospital that come this end-stage disease, et cetera, and you do the Ahmed valve for them, and they do okay initially, and then the resident's got to learn how to manage, late IOP rise from fibrosis, and you're just blocking any outflow around that foot plate. That's obviously a very important thing. And then the other thing is that what you lecture frequently on is dealing with tube erosions and tube not fitting, and you have the turtle protocol. First, I said the name, what do you mean she's turtle?
It's a turtle plast. It's like a tutoplast, but it's a turtle.
But when you explained it, I was like, yo, that is genius. The head, I won't even tell it, but the head goes and fills the gap in the hole, then the body, and then the four suturers of the legs. Okay, let me have you explain it. You do a better job than me, but I think it's absolute genius. I've never heard of this before in my life.
Thanks. Well, so first of all, these eyes with Ahmeds, Tubes in general, they work by growing a capsule around the end plate. All tubes do that. You put any kind of foreign body in a human body, and it's going to grow scar tissue around it. And for non-valve tubes, we want a scar tissue to grow around the plate. Otherwise, the pressure is going to be zero. So a little bit of encapsulation is good and necessary. Otherwise, the pressure can get too low. But in these AMEDs, because you plug them in and the fluid flows right away, you get a really thick capsule, not a really thin capsule. And a lot of people have different strategies for how to make the capsule thinner. For example, at UCSF, they use mitomycin. So Ying Han uses mitomycin. My colleague from Chicago, Minji Kang from Northwestern, she frequently lectures on mitomycin with her AMEDs to try to reduce the encapsulation around the end plate. But nonetheless, your body is just going to want to grow scar tissue because that's what immune systems do. And especially for NVG, you can actually grow a fibrovascular stalk up the valve. And I've seen that before when doing a tube removal or exchange. I yanked out a thick fibrovascular stalk. And I'm like, of course your tube has failed. There's this fibrovascular stalk clogging it. And you know, you can try to needle the edge of the capsule, but it's really thick. And so when I'm faced with an eye that has had a failed AMED from before, I will do a same quadrant tube exchange for a non-valve tube in the sulcus, because usually that first tube's probably in the AC as well. And if they're not pseudophakic, I will make them pseudophakic because pseudophakia is a gift. And sometimes it can be really hard to close the track that the old tube came out of. And sometimes, especially like in the past, a lot of AMEDs were put into the eye right at the limbus without a long tunnel, because I think that was the technique that was done originally, and then later surgeons switched to doing a more of a tunnel up the sclera. And so sometimes the sclerotomy into the eye is just like literally a hole punch, like right in at the limbus. And it can be very hard to suture a hole like that closed because you can't get it watertight. It's just literally so short. And if you do try to suture it closed very tightly, you're going to get a ton of sill. Mm-hmm. And so I had seen a video from Keith Barton, who is the head of glaucoma at Moorfields, and it was on his Instagram and YouTube channel. His YouTube is like glaucoma underscore surgery, so he's like the king of glaucoma surgery YouTube videos. And he had done a triangular piece of pseudoplast, and you just cut a triangle and stuff it up the hole, and you can glue it into place or suture it into place. And I have
so the apex of the triangle goes in that kind of hole.
It's like a doorstop. So like the apex of the triangle goes into the hole, and then it gets wider as it goes, so it kind of blocks the hole. And then as you hydrate this piece of pseudoplast, it expands. And so it kind of like fills up more space. You put it in there dry, and then you like hydrate it, and it gets bigger and it plugs the hole. And so when I first had a case of like a tube exchange where this was relevant, not only did I need to remove the tube and plug the hole, which was short and anterior, this patient had scleral thinning from this just underlying kind of scleral melt situation. And so the sclera was kind of, the integrity of the sclera was not good either. So I wanted to cover up a much wider area than just plug the hole. And so I took the piece of pseudoplast, which is a rectangle, and I cut it into like a jigsaw puzzle shape or like a Tetris piece where you have like a big square down here and then like a little nub sticking up above it. And I took the little nub and plugged it into the sclerotomy hole. And then the rest of it was a big rectangle that was just outside, and we hydrated it. And then I sutured down the four corners. And when I looked down at the microscope, it just looked like a turtle. It was just like a little head and then like four legs and like a little round body. And I was like, this looks like a turtle. I remember the case very distinctly. I was scrubbed in with my resident, Peter Weber, and a medical student, Sylvia, who ended up writing up this, we all wrote this up together. And we were just like, we've got to come up with a cute name for this because it's like a little turtle. And so we went with turtleplast because it's a pseudoplast. And this little shape is useful for basically plugging holes when you need to remove a tube, or even if you need to revise a trab. Anytime where you need to just plug a hole, you can take a piece of pseudoplast and use it to plug it and not just overlay it. Because when you overlay it, it's not guaranteed to have a watertight seal. But if you plug it and then you put it in dry and then you hydrate it later, it will expand to fill the space like a sponge. And so that turtleplast paper that we published, you know, we talked about this technique at IGC, and Arshim Shabani from WashU, his fellow Gio had said, like, we have a similar case. And so they also had a video where they removed an eroded.
Gio was my resident.
Gio was your resident?
Yes.
Small world, yeah. And so we showed their case too, where they removed a tube and they cut a piece of pseudoplast. It wasn't really like, theirs wasn't really a turtle. It was more like a horse because it was sort of oblique and the head went that way and the legs went this way, but same idea. And so we kind of published this 2-case series showing that you can take tutoplasm and sort of sculpt it into the shape that you need and then use it to stuff the hole. We have recently kind of used this turtleplast technique in this novel way where we had an eye with hypotony maculopathy after a trabeculectomy. And we just presented this at AGS. My fellow Sam Goldberg presented it at the Super Bowl of Grand Rounds at AGS. And it was a really interesting case because it was a myopic man with pigmentary glaucoma who got a GAT first, but he failed the GAT. Like, we started with the MIGS first, and then he got a TRAB. It was actually my fellowship year, so I was in on that case. And then the TRAB functioned for a little while, but then he got hypotony, and he got a revision where they tried to suture the flap flap tighter, but then he got a bleb leak, and then he got hypotony again, and he had all this hypotony maculopathy, and his vision was blurry. And then they tried to repair it again by taking a large piece of tutoplast and putting it over the old TRAB flap and suturing it down tightly. However, it didn't create a watertight seal. And so he was still having hypotony maculopathy and blurry vision despite this patch graft and everything. And so at that point, I had returned to Cleveland Clinic 5 years later, and this was a patient of my mentor. And he said, you know, why don't you go see Mary? Maybe she's got some new ideas or something. Right. And so I took a look at him and I was like, let me try one more time. You know, let me see what if I can try to shut this TRAB down. And so we opened up everything and we saw the old patch graft and it was leaking out the back end because it wasn't really watertight. And then we opened it up and we saw the scleral flap was melted. We saw an old compression suture that wasn't holding anything down anymore because the sclera was melted. And so we made a little turtle and we stuffed the head in the hole and we put the legs down and then we put the other patch graft down and we closed up and it worked. And even though he had hypotony for like 5 years, his vision recovered from 21/25 to 20/40. And the craziest thing actually is that the TRAB didn't even fail. His pressure's 12 on zero meds. Like, after all that, we were trying to shut the TRAB down. It still was trickling a little bit. Like, despite our best attempt to make it super great, it was still flowing. So we actually ended up with this miraculously good result where we didn't overshoot, even though we were frankly just trying to shut it down. But we showed this at AGS to highlight that this turtleplast concept, or just kind of plugging things with tutoplast, can work for TRABs as well as tubes. And recently, Sam Goldberg, my fellow, and my mentor, John Isengard, they had done a case of a tube removal where they actually used the capsule tissue as the thing to stuff the hole.
The lens capsule.
Not the lens capsule, but the tube capsule.
Oh, the so tube capsule.
The actual encapsulated scar tissue that's around the tube. That tissue, everyone just sort of thinks of that tissue as the enemy, all that scar tissue that's making our tubes fail. But actually, that tissue is wonderful,
right?
Autologous, a little vascular. It's has structure.
Shove it in there.
Yeah, you can do a lot of stuff with that capsule. And so, also while I was at University of Chicago, I started doing this capsule autograft thing where when I was doing a tube revision or tube removal or tube exchange, and I needed to patch up the new area, I would actually harvest the surface of the capsule from the old tube that I removed.
Why not? Don't throw it away.
Yeah, the first time I removed it, I threw it away. And the second time I was like, save that in a little cup of BSS. Let's use it. And so now we frequently use this capsule autograft for a variety of things, but I had never used it to stuff a hole. And then just this year when we came back to Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Isengard had a case where he used it to actually stuff the sclerotomy. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like, we should definitely, you know, put that out there. And so I had published my series and technique about the capsule autograft, which I had come up with on my own. But as I was writing that paper, I found a paper by Dr. Kahook, where he had also described using capsule tissue to repair tube erosions for AMEDs that had eroded. So I was like, oh, must be a good idea if Dr. Kahook thought of it too.
Right.
And so now we've been trying to share this technique at AGS over the years. And I've been submitting videos to the surgical video competition like every year, trying to highlight some of these new techniques so that it can sort of catch on. And so
we'll feature a video on cataract codes. It'll get tens of thousands of views the first day. Don't worry about it.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's slowly catching on because now when I go to AGS, sometimes somebody will be like, oh, I tried that capsule technique, you know, and it really like helped a lot with this case. And it's just kind of nice to hear that the stuff you put out there, like people are hearing it and seeing it and getting to try it. And it's helping patients, you know, around the country and around the world. So that is awesome that Cataract Coach as a platform has been able to do that with so many great techniques.
Well, that's why I got to get you on the podcast. When I heard your lecture, I was like, I got to get her on my podcast. She's like such great info. The way you think is totally different. You're changing the dogma. You're shaking it up. You're making me ask well, why? Is there a better way? And I think you really have come across a truly better way. So, well, the work you're doing is fantastic. Now, you also mentioned a lot of young doctors in this podcast. And so you clearly have a big, huge heart, and you love teaching and training this next generation, whether they're fellows, residents, or even med students. And that makes me really proud. You mentioned Gio Campagna, who was one of my last residents I trained. What an incredible young doctor. Oh, my gosh. Incredible. So tell me about fostering kind of this kind of thinking methods in the young doctors. How do you teach them kind of surgical judgment and how to, your approach?
Yeah. I mean, this is enough content for a whole other hour. I love teaching. I was the president of the tutoring club in high school.
Hard
to match up tutors with two T's for, different subjects. I was the head TA in my undergrad biology lab, and we redesigned a curriculum for like all the different hands-on labs within bio, like cell bio and animal bio and everything.
Right.
I was always just like the person who wanted to like teach MCAT class, and I always loved that. And so to finally be able to teach the thing that I've dedicated my whole life to, which is glaucoma surgery, it's like, I've always liked teaching. I just didn't know what I wanted to teach. And finally I found the thing that I love to teach, which is glaucoma surgery. And I feel like I'm even trying to push the envelope a little bit on like teaching people when they're younger and younger and younger. Like you can get, very young people involved hands-on in the wet lab, let them try something. You can let junior residents get involved hands-on in the operating room after they practice in the wet lab. Once you observe them, we can create standardized rubrics to measure their progress and not just, give them off the cuff casual feedback, but more structured feedback with rubrics and scores and everything. We can, instead of when they come to the OR and you just let them do whatever, like you kind of prime them beforehand. Oh, today we're going to focus on just this one step. Like when I teach a tube the very first day, the junior resident will be able to help with some steps. You're going to, ligate the tube, and you're going to be able to, suture the patch graft on, for example. Okay. Those are very low risk steps that they can practice in the wet lab that I can ensure that they can do safely. And then they can start to participate in the surgery as an assistant. And I just think that getting people involved at a young stage in their training helps them build interest in the field, gets them a little bit of dexterity, gets them a little bit of judgment to like, how do I get this tension of the patch graft down without a very, very high risk situation of doing important steps of very complex cases. So I think it's important to start very early on in the process. And I like to try to reflect after every day. I was doing this thing at the beginning of the year where I had everyone text the group, like we did a group chat, and it would be like, what's three things you learned today? And sometimes it's not just the trainee on my clinic, because we have a service with a resident that's a junior, a resident that's a senior, and a fellow, soon to be two. And for a while I was doing these like group chats. I think every day was too frequent, so you want to scale it back to every week. But what is three top things that you learned today? And then everyone can share their pearls with each other, because maybe you learned something in Dr. Eisengart's clinic, but you learned something in Dr. Sood's OR, and you learned something in Dr. Singh's clinic. And that way the learning is kind of magnified exponentially, because everyone's sharing everything they learned. And that's why I love being at conferences. And I kind of wanted to create like a conference vibe, like just kind of at home every day at work. So I've also launched a monthly surgical case conference for the residents and fellows for glaucoma at Cole. They didn't used to do a surgical case conference. And, this helps the residents reflect on their own videos by editing the video. Because I started learning how to edit video when I was a resident at Wilmer. We had this thing called the No Vitreous Society, where we would edit our videos of any cataract complications and go to an attending's house and get pizza and talk about our cases. And I thought we should do this for glaucoma.
Right.
In the process of doing that and editing my own videos, it helps me reflect on the case, because you have to watch it back in slow motion one microsecond at a time as you're cutting it. And you really notice things that happened during the surgery that you didn't notice while you were doing. It's kind of like, okay, I just got into football like 2 months ago because my husband's really into football. So before the Super Bowl, I learned everything about football. And it's like watching the tapes. Like when you have a football game and you watch it back, I try to teach the residents that they have to record every case, download all your cases, get a huge hard drive and store them, watch back your cases. And then in the process of editing the video to teach others about your case, you get to actually reflect on what's important about the case, what's pertinent, what moves you did well, what stuff you could do differently. And then they get to teach their peers every month. And then they generate a little portfolio for themselves of cool cases that they participated in as a resident that they can use to submit to conferences, to present nationwide and internationally, to start their own YouTube channel so that they can kind of build their professional brand as well. So just even something like that, like starting a little surgical case conference as part of my just getting people excited about learning and teaching others and kind of just spreading knowledge broadly. It's not just learn so I can do it, but like learn so I can teach others too. And I'm always like, video or it didn't happen. You know, you could have like the coolest case, but if you don't have a video of it to show other people, it's just like a memory. Like, what if you made up the whole thing? What if it was just a dream? You know, so I'm always like, we got to take slit lamp photos before and after. We have to get videos of the procedure so that we can disseminate this knowledge widely. And I think I've done a decent job of kind of instilling that interest in my trainees that, you know, taking care of the patient is important to help the patient, but it's also important to teach everyone else about this so that they can help more patients too.
Oh, I love it. Wow, you are amazing. I mean, I tell you right now, the Coli Institute and Cleveland Clinic are so lucky to have you. You bring such incredible high level of expertise and even better, that level of enthusiasm and like pushing the envelope. And I have zero doubt you're definitely going to change the way we treat, certainly NVG. Because now that you mentioned it, it makes zero sense not to classify it along the spectrum. It makes zero sense. So I think you are doing amazing work. I can't believe we've been talking for more than 1 hour. So time flies when you're having fun. But Mary Q, I want to thank you so much for this podcast. You are an incredible resource, certainly the future face of glaucoma in the U.S. and probably abroad too. And I enjoyed talking to you. I definitely want to feature one of your videos tomorrow. So you give me whatever video you want. We'll get it disseminated to a worldwide audience.
Thank you so much. And thank you everyone for tuning in to this episode. Follow me on Instagram, MaryQMD, and follow my YouTube channel, which is also MaryQMD, and follow my dog Hopkins.
I will leave all the links down below. Give me the links. I'll put them right down below.
Thank you.
And a reminder, listeners and viewers, remember, I got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast, you definitely find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, we have a new Cataract Coach video every single day, almost 2,900 days in a row and counting. Still never missed a day. And video 3,000 is coming up this July. Be there. Until next time, I'll catch you later.